I'd like to use this time to talk about some of the opportunities and challenges in using coding to advance clinician competence in MI. And when I say clinicians, I don't just mean therapists. I mean people who are using MI in a variety of different contexts, including people who work in medical settings and criminal justice settings, child welfare settings, and so on. These are all contexts in which I think people use various types of MI, different elements of MI, and our ability to evaluate their competence is the same no matter which setting they're working in. And whether or not we might use the same tool to do that, I think, is a good question. But certainly the idea of evaluating people is the same. So coding grew up with MI. Was it in 1992 that was it? Bill, are you here? When was it that you guys developed the MISC? It was on your sabbatical in Oregon, wasn't it? So, when Bill took his, part of Bill's sabbatical was to, do a research project in which they needed to evaluate whether clinicians were actually using motivational interviewing and developed the MISC to do that, worked with Denise and some other people in Oregon to make sure that happened. And the MISC since then has evolved in various directions, and there are various different branches stemming from this original MISC coding system that we're going to talk about. In our lab, there are also other evaluations of motivational interviewing, Claire Lane's Becky, the MIA STEP evaluation tool, and so on, that are not directly stemming from the MISC, but in many ways have elements of it. An encouraging thing is that there's a common thread across coding instruments in capturing some elements of motivational interviewing. And although these different sorts of coding instruments are good because they allow us to have common elements and also evaluate unique elements that are to a particular setting, it can be frustrating for the person who wants to just use a standardized coding system. And I get lots of calls and emails from people who say, I just want the best one. Which is the best one? And I never know the answer to that because each one really serves a different purpose. The MITEI, for example, was developed because I had people who called me up and they wanted a fidelity monitoring tool for motivational interviewing. And then I told them about the MISC. And I said, you know, it has 27 different therapist codes and it has about, you know, 9 different client codes and it takes 3 different passes of an hour-long tape and, you know, it takes about, you know, a year and a half to train people to do it. And then once they're trained, they quit because it's very tedious. And they say, like, are you kidding? And so I had so many of those emails, and right at that time there was no other fidelity monitoring tool for MI. So Tim Martin and I did a factor. We said, well, is there any simpler way we can do this? And Tim said to me, that's a data reduction question. It's simply a data reduction question. So we took all of the therapist elements or clinician elements from the MISC, and we did a factor analysis and derived a smaller number of factors, and those became the MISC, the MITEI. When people say to me, well, why did you do it this way? I say, we didn't do it that way. That's what the data told us, right? This was simply a factor analysis. The MITEI uses both, as you know, both global ratings and behavior counts, and that's a strength of the MITEI that some of the other fidelity tools don't have. And the MITEI, as I've said before, and Denise said, captures only beginning-level practice, which is a very frustrating weakness for people like those in this room. So people who are trying to train motivational interviewing to a high degree of skill and expertise often find the MITEI a very, very frustrating tool. And I can't tell you how many times people call me and say, how come you don't put this on the MITEI? How come you don't put that on the MITEI? How come you left this off? Like, you idiot, don't you understand that there's more to motivational interviewing than questions and reflections? Yes, I do understand that. Along came a research project in which we wanted to answer specific questions about the sequence of events in MI because there were some specific hypotheses derived from Bill's writings that said if you see these sorts of things happen from therapists and clinicians, you ought to see Change Talk following next. So what we did was we modified the MISC to allow it to be used in a sequential fashion. And we had to change lots of things about the MISC to allow that to be so. And in doing so, we developed a coding system called the SCOPE, which is the sequential coding of process exchanges. And the SCOPE is an adaptation of the MISC that allows it to be done in a sequential fashion. What happens when you begin to code things sequentially is that you have to code them utterance by utterance. And that means that when you're comparing reliability, you have to do it in an utterance by utterance fashion. So that means that what Casey codes, I have to match the exact utterance that Casey codes to the exact utterance that Melanie codes and see whether they were a hit or a miss. And that's not something you have to do with the Mighty. You just use frequency counts and you code on the fly. But when you're doing sequential coding, you have to parse things into very small bytes, and then you have to make sure that the byte that one coder was coding is the same byte that the next coder was coding and see whether they matched or they didn't. It's a very much higher and more rigorous standard of evaluating the reliability of the psychometric properties of the instruments than you have for the Mighty. That's all I'm going to say about it, except to say that the SCOPE is a very labor-intensive instrument and really only useful and only worthwhile if you want to answer questions about the processes that occur within motivational interviewing. It's definitely too labor-intensive for real people, and you actually have to have indentured servants to do it. And by that I mean, of course, graduate students. In this process, although we ended up with an instrument that was really too complicated for the real world, and I'm really even reluctant to give it away. You know, I hesitate to give the SCOPE away. Where's Liz Barnett? There she is. People keep saying to me, I want to use the SCOPE, I want to use the SCOPE, and I refuse to give it to them. Who have I refused to give it to? Raise your hand if I've refused to give you the SCOPE. But Liz finally talked me into it, and I gave it to her, and aren't you sorry I did?
No.
Yes, she is. We had to develop a special software in order to use the SCOPE. So part of our grant, one of the things we had to do was actually build software from the ground up to be able to allow this software coding. We're now beta testing the secondary version or the final version? Right, it's almost the final version. We're beta testing it. So soon we'll have software to give away, by the way, to go with the SCOPE coding software and the coding system. And I think that will make it marginally easier for people. But it is a very daunting thing to try to develop a sequential coding system, develop software, and a manual which allows people to use both the software and the coding system together without getting a single email when people use it, which is my goal. The iteration, if you take away the sequentialness of the SCOPE, you're left with the changes that we made in the MISC to make it more reliable, and that is the MISC 3 software, am I right? I mean, the MISC 3 coding system, am I right? Thank you. And the MISC 2.5, then, is something that we will release for general use, and that is, I think, an improvement of the MISC in particularly allowing coders to be more reliable in things like capturing therapist behaviors and particularly change talk in clients. Again, this is a research tool and very much more too cumbersome for the real world, for people who really just want to evaluate whether clinicians are progressing and whether they're using MI well. What are some of the advantages of using coding and promoting good practice? For one thing, clinicians get feedback, and I think everybody in this room probably understands how revolutionary it is to begin to evaluate, to remove or to initiate some transparency in the process of evaluating how people are doing psychotherapy. So instead of closing the door and letting the magic happen, we are actually beginning to examine the process of psychotherapy, and by that I mean motivational interviewing, in a way that allows us to give clinicians feedback so that they might get better. And specifically, when you're using a tool, any of the evaluation tools really that have been developed for quality assurance and MI, you're giving clinicians numbers. And you're saying, here are your numbers. And that is a very revolutionary thing that has not usually happened when people are trained to do psychotherapy. It's difficult to overstate the importance of advancing therapy practice when people submit their work for practice, for observation. And it is, in fact, becoming a benchmark of expert practice in MI. And I know that one of the things that is being asked of people who are coming into TNTs now is, has anybody reviewed your work? Have you ever asked for consultation? Have you ever submitted a tape of yourself and had it evaluated? Has anybody ever watched you work, either in person or behind a one-way mirror? Have you ever allowed your work to become transparent and put yourself in a situation where you could receive feedback about it? And you would be surprised how few people can meet that standard of practice, even though they would like to come to a TNT and present themselves as MI experts. It is not unusual for a person to come to a TNT and to say, I'm an expert in motivational interviewing, and never have had a single person evaluate their work in any way whatsoever. Right? So this coding changes that. And it allows us to provide relatively objective feedback to people. And we know, of course, what happens when people get objective feedback about their work, don't we? Right? What happens when you when you're learning to play the piano? And you get practice and you get feedback from a teacher, you get better. If you're trying to learn how to serve a forehand in tennis, you get better because you get feedback. If you're golfing and you see whether your swing took the ball to the hole or not, you get better because your feedback is immediate and your feedback is concrete and objective. What now? And go do something else, right? The MI, psychotherapy is not for everyone, right? Seriously. You might be good at a lot of things and not necessarily have a career in MI. One point I want to make is that numbers in and of themselves, unlike golf, tennis, and other kinds of things where the simple objective feedback is immediately in front of you, typically giving people numbers about how well they do in psychotherapy is not helpful, and in fact, it can be disturbing to people. One of the things we found in the EMI project, in which there was a group of people who received only numbers, that's all they got, was their we coded their sessions and sent them their numbers, and believe me, they were not happy about it. Right? They were pretty annoyed to get, and sometimes very upset, to just get a sheet of paper saying, you know, you're a 2 on empathy. You're a 2 out of 5. And that's it. You don't get any other feedback, right? And, you know, for some people it was disturbing enough that they actually told us, you know, this is disturbing to me. And part of the reason it's disturbing is because these are people who want to get better. Obviously, they're in a training study and they want to get better. But part of the reason it's disturbing is because when you're talking about psychotherapy, unlike surgery, you know, if you are not good at surgery, then that means you're not good at a skill and you can get better. When you're not good at psychotherapy, it somehow becomes about who you are as a person. And so I really always encourage people to use these numbers in the context of a consulting or a supervisory relationship so that people don't just get a number, but they also get opportunities to figure out ways to get better at what they're doing. I also want to point out that rating for competence is something that's probably pretty good at helping you figure out who to hire. If you want to train people to do motivational interviewing, having them do a work sample and code it with the MITEI will tell you how hard you're going to have to work to train them. We know that because we've used it to recruit people in clinical trials, not the MITEI, but other things. So it's probably not a bad idea at the front of a hiring process, but it's a terrible way to make a decision to terminate anybody because the MITEI only gives you one sample, and it also doesn't allow you to control for whether the client was intoxicated during the session or other kinds of things that might really impact the way that session with. So challenges, those are the advantages. What are the challenges in using feedback to promote good practice? Well, one is that, as I said it before, we cannot capture advanced practice. The elements that move people from a very basic level of MI practice, first of all, people who cannot practice MI at all have a big jump to make to use basic counseling skills well, to not confront clients, to struggle with supporting client autonomy, to be collaborative. Those are all really, that's a big jump. From zero to basic proficiency is a big jump. There's another big jump coming from basic proficiency to really expert status, in which you are actively and strategically evoking change talk, in which you are actively encouraging client self-exploration, and so on. We can't capture those advanced elements of practice. The problem lies really in coding the clinician intent for using these strategic approaches as opposed to simply responding to what the client is saying. So if the client offers a statement that's itchy or resistant, we can code pretty reliably what the clinician does next, and we can identify it. But how do we code when the clinician is thinking, oh, I'm going to do this, and then the client's going to say that, and then I'm going to say this, and then the client's going to say that, and then, boom, I get to evoking change talk? How do you code the clinician's intent for strategically arranging that conversation so that it happens? Unlike topographic elements of the speech and the volleys between the therapist and the client, you can't code that kind of intent topographically. We can code, is it a question or is it a reflection? And by the way, that turns out to be a really powerful tool in improving clinical practice. Just simply giving people the question-to-reflection ratio that they're using in a session and helping them to increase the number of reflections and the quality of their reflections is a huge improvement in practice. But it's not exactly what you would call an advanced MI skill. That's a basic counseling skill that people can use in a variety of different therapies, and it's not really unique to MI or an advanced element of MI. So, the reason that we can't get these elements is because coders have difficulty coming to reliability when they're trying to judge the intent of the therapist before the act occurs. When you code, you're coding in real time, and the coder has to make a decision about how to code something before they go on to the next thing. And what they can't do is they can't go back and change their codes based on what happens later in the session. Now, theoretically, you could do that, and the way you sort of do that is when you use global ratings. And the person listens to the entire session, and then they make an overall or gestalt rating of how the session went. But if you're coding topographical elements or utterances as you go, you need to code and then move on and not go back and change what you coded before. And getting therapists to reliability when you're talking about strategic elements is not possible. So will globals save the day? Well, the solution of using globals is tricky. And some of the rating systems for motivational interviewing rest entirely on using globals. And there's nothing wrong with that, except they're tricky, because they don't provide a common metric across studies. Does my empathy global mean the same as your empathy global? And, you know, we've done some things to try to massage that and to make a common metric. We revised the MITEI. It's now at 3.1. We added a bunch of verbal anchors to the global ratings so that every single number that's assigned on the MITEI has a verbal description to go with it, and hopefully that allows people who are coding the MITEI in different contexts to become more consistent in the way they rate. But I don't really think that that's probably as good as we can do, and I don't know that I have a lot of faith in the fact that a 4 rated over here in this study is the same as a 4 rated over here in that study, in the same way that I have faith that your question to reflection ratio is 3-1 and yours is 3-1, and I think that's probably the same, right? Using globals tends to elicit a restricted range of responses from coders, and so coders usually code the midpoint. So they drift towards the mean, and you have to do a lot of things to get coders not to do that, and you have to work hard to increase their ability to detect scores on either end of the scale. And if you don't keep on top of that, they drift back to the middle. And so what you have is a compressed range of scores. Even when coders really aren't doing the same thing, coders are rating them that way because of their tendency to rate the mean. And also getting reliability on globals is very difficult. And so anybody that uses global scales will tell you that getting reliability on globals is a lot harder than getting reliability, and keeping it is a lot harder than getting reliability on using something, a topographical element of the interaction, such as whether the person is using questions or reflections. So I'm saying stay tuned, because this is a problem we're going to have to solve, and we're grappling with in our lab. We really want to figure this out. And a study that Lisa recently published in which we actually manipulated, the therapists actually manipulated whether or not they were trying to elicit change talk in clients, and we did see an impact. It was just a beautiful relationship between therapists doing something and the amount of change talk that clients would give. And so we know that therapists can influence change talk. And if they're doing that intentionally, they must be doing something specific. So we just have to figure out the right way to capture that, and we will. It's in the works. It's our next step. And we also know that in addition to gaining the ability and expertise in managing these advanced elements of practice is going to include the client's experience as well. And not only what are therapists doing, but what is the impact that that's immediately having on the client. Change talk is part of the picture, and Denise is now going to be telling you about another part of the picture, which is client self-exploration.
So while I'm putting this up, I want to say you really ought to be glad, any of you that are interested in MISC coding, that we took out in the first version of the MISC, we had the talk time. And Steve, you may remember this, the machine that we got set up to do talk time. So it was before the digital age, you know, where you could capture the amount of time people were speaking very easily. And one of our colleagues made a machine that had two timers on it. And you had to ding the timer when this person started talking and then turn it off when they stopped, and ding the timer when this person started talking. So you're just like, what? I was completely impaired. Steve Burke Smith was able to do it well, but I had to farm my time, talk time out to other people because I could not do that. So it's no longer in the picture.
By the time we started doing it at CASA, it was the digital age, and so we downloaded an application which was two stopwatches, right? So the person had two stopwatches on their computer, and they just hit the button on the computer.
So you were still having to do this. I still couldn't have done it. I can tell you, I couldn't. It takes a special person to do that.
It is good to talk about.
Right. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about self-exploration and the history of that. And what really started me thinking about this is that, you know, Bill has always said to us that where we learn how to do motivational interviewing is from our clients. And so, you know, things like the MITEI measure what we do, and they're really important. Our skill level is really important, how deep we get our reflections, how well we track with the person, you know, the kinds of questions we ask. And those things are really important. But how can we help clinicians learn from their clients? And that's what sort of led me on this journey about self-exploration. So I'm not just following Terry around. I'm doing something. A little bit of history about the self-exploration scale, because it's currently in the MISC, and it started out in MISC 2.0. And I'm going to get to that in a minute. But the scale was originally developed by Truax and Karkoff, and by the way, they have just put out a new edition. It's not a new edition, but they reprinted the book Toward an Effective Psychotherapy, written by Truax and Karkoff. And if you get a chance, you can now order that book on Amazon, and it is an excellent book. It talks about the development of the empathy scale as well, and it has all the facilitative conditions that Rogers talked about and has some great descriptions about it and examples. So I highly recommend it. The self-exploration scale was originally developed by them, and they have a whole series of studies that they did looking at the relationship to outcome. Now, the only funny thing about that is that the outcome they were looking at, for the most part, the patients they were dealing with were hospitalized psychiatric patients. So we're talking about fairly severe pathology going on. And they also were looking at the outcome measures. Many of the outcome measures were related to changes in the MMPI. So it's a little bit different, but the scale's really valuable. I think it would be really interesting to test it out in today to really look at. I'm looking forward to the research on this. But the other thing that was interesting in going back and looking at this is when they developed it, they developed the self-exploration scale as a tool to help clinicians within the session ensure their effectiveness. So that was the whole purpose of it, was a training purpose, so that if they trained the clinicians in how to recognize self-exploration, that they could then become more effective in the moment in their therapy, because the goal was to increase self-exploration. And they were seeing good psychiatric or good therapeutic outcomes from increased self-exploration. I thought that was interesting that they developed it for that. They also found in the studies that they did that they actually had a study that looked at what percentage of the variance in self-exploration was related to the client, and the vast majority of the variance related to self-exploration rests with the client. So the client is really controlling most of it, and we have a very strong influence over how much self-exploration, how deep the self-exploration is. And we do that by offering the facilitative conditions. So back to Rogers and the empathy, the warmth, the genuineness, offering those things up are really important. They actually had a really interesting study that they did where they trained a client to manipulate her self-exploration.
Thank you.
And they trained her to do like about 20 minutes of really good self-exploration and then to shut it off and get real trivial and superficial, and then to spend the last 20 minutes of the session once again doing self-exploration. And they tested several different therapists, in which they divided them into those that were really good at the facilitative conditions. They were high-functioning therapists, and those that were really low in the facilitative conditions to start with. And they found differences in the way they responded. First of all, none of them mentioned, well, that was really funny, the person really changed their level of self-exploration. They didn't mention that. But the folks that were high functioning in terms of their facilitative conditions, when they started out at a high level, and when the person's self-exploration, went down, they just kept going. They kept offering a high level of the facilitative conditions. They kept trying to link the personal material, what they had heard previously, to this. They kept trying to personalize this trivial material the person was offering. So they kept offering linkages and trying to get them to do that. And then finally, when the person came back up and started doing self-exploration again, they actually offered more. So they never dipped. They stayed well. They stayed all the way through there. They worked. It was like they trusted that those facilitative conditions were going to work no matter what. And then they even got better when the person started responding again. The folks that were not so good at it to begin with, that started out fairly low, and as soon as the person quit offering self-exploration, they quit offering the facilitative conditions. And even when the person started self-exploring again, they didn't come back. It was like they went, not going to happen, I'm done, and didn't come back. And I thought that was a pretty interesting thing, that they were not necessarily noticing that the person's self-exploration changed, but that those facilitative conditions were having those nailed down and trusting that those will work no matter what is beneficial. We also affect the self-exploration through the reflection process, what we choose to reflect, the deeper level reflections, responding to the personal material in a way that really helps expand on it, and by reinforcing and rewarding the self-exploration. So they found that the really high-functioning therapists really rewarded, they actively rewarded the self-exploration by seeking elaboration and by engaging the person even more. So in the MISC, the way we got the self-exploration scale into the MISC was that we had four client globals in MISC 1. And that's the whole development of the MISC, which was a really fun process, is another story for another day. But we had four client globals that we thought might be important in that first round. Their affect, how much affect they expressed, their cooperation, disclosure, and engagement. And what we found is just the same way that Terry found with the Mighty, when you put them all into a factor analysis, they hung together. Well, that's what happened here. So if they got a 4 on affect, the chances were they had a 4 on disclosure. So we decided that it might make sense, since we were consolidating the globals for the therapist that it might make sense to consolidate it, and the self-exploration scale was a really likely candidate. And some of the preliminary work that's been done indicates that it follows the same pattern. So the therapist skill really does influence or does predict the self-exploration. So there's some, or at least is associated with it. The difference between this global, and I'm going to talk about it at a global level and an utterance level, but at the global level, the difference between self-exploration and the therapist globals, which the therapist globals average over time what's happening. The self-exploration scale is intended to pick out the high point. What's the high point of self-exploration? So you're identifying, so when you're coding this, which you're going to be doing in a minute, when you're coding it, you want to look for that high point. What's that, what is that? So I did my dissertation on, and this is not about my dissertation, and where's Vaughn? Is Vaughn here? I'm not self-disclosing about Vaughn's nurses, but I did my dissertation using self-exploration, working with recorded health coaching sessions in nurses that Vaughn had very aptly trained and supervised. And what I did find in this is that in terms of the relationship with the therapist behaviors, that the global measures, that all of the global measures, and I did a combination of them in the final analysis, but the global, including empathy, and I had empathy, acceptance, and MI spirit, the percentage of complex reflections, the number of support statements, because this is MISC and it breaks everything down, remember, and the length of session. So because these were brief sessions, so the self-exploration was increased by longer sessions, of course, that makes sense. And those were all positively associated with greater self-exploration. When I went back and really looked at, because I had transcripts for all these, and when I went back and really looked in depth at what was happening related to the self-exploration, the thing that I found is that the patients in this case, because this was a nurse-led health coaching program, the patients were spontaneously offering personal material all the time. If you look at the transcripts, and they might not be really in depth, but they were throwing out nuggets. They were given material all the time, and it was systematically not recognized, elicited, or responded to by the clinician. So the clinicians were thinking something else. They weren't really responding to it, but the patients were offering it. So it wasn't that it wasn't there, that you had to really go digging for it. They were offering it, and it wasn't being responded to. So what? So my sense is, and Terry mentioned this, and actually Allie mentioned it in her introduction, but one of the primary tasks that we have in training clinicians is helping them take it, not miss opportunities. I mean, the missed opportunities are just abundant, and anyone who's done coding, even with people who are pretty good at MI, there's just an abundance of missed opportunities. That we are helping them to deepen the conversation, and we want to strategically shape their speech, and we want to get change talk eventually. And I really think that much of what we see in self-exploration is where those nuggets are going to be that will eventually lead, with our great skill, will lead to really good solid change talk. So the hints are in the self-exploration. It is also in that self-exploration that it provides us the material for why this is important to the client and what might help us to deepen, what we might choose to reflect, and what might help us deepen that conversation so that we can actually link it up with their values and really strengthen that change talk. And it is a great way for us to learn from our clients. If we can learn about that process, we can pay attention to it in the therapy session, we can, in the same way that we attend a change talk, right? This is, in some ways, it's really similar. It's just another thing that we're listening for in that session that can help us get better. So what is self-exploration? This is basically the list from... And we may end up expanding it because, Rogers was really concerned about emotion. And he, as far as in the original development of this, you had to have a lot of feeling associated with this. And, you know, some people just aren't that feeling-oriented. But so we've done some revision of it to include more the cognitive processes that could be involved. But it's not out yet. Maybe we'll put it in 2.5. It's really dealing with personally relevant material. So problems, vulnerabilities, self-descriptions, any indication of values or life choices or what's important, if they're expressing feelings, if they're talking about their roles or their relationships with others, their sense of self-worth, any of those things can be evidence of self-exploration. This is the 5-point scale. In the MISC, it's still currently a 7-point scale. We have started the work toward the 5-point scale. So because I couldn't fit 7 points on here very well, I'm giving you 5 to code today, because 7 is too many. So it basically goes from the client not responding at all and the client to them actively engaging in it, where you all would recognize that when the person is actually changing their perception of themselves, and they're really thinking, that's when they're really on. And you don't see a ton of fives out there, but you all know the moments. And again, it's the high point that you're looking for. So are you ready? I want you to take a look at that, because when we code this, we're going to code, and I'm going to bring it back up afterwards, but we're going to do one of the things with the global measures that we do. First of all, we're going to just listen to it. This is a 6-minute sample. You're going to listen to it all the way through, and then you're going to make a determination about the self-exploration, the level of self-exploration. Okay? And again, it's the high point. We deliberately have chosen to do audio because all of our coding is done with audio. And it's not that there aren't good video coding systems out there that can be very beneficial, and we all know that shaping nonverbal behavior is really an important thing as well. But for our coding systems, we do audio. So we chose that. And we also chose a sample that was done for coding training. So it's not an expert, because the purpose of this is to try to help us find ways of taking people who aren't experts already and helping them move in that direction. Okay? So you have a transcript. We're not going to work with the transcript right now. We're going to do a second round of this and going a little deeper. For this time, what I want you to do is to listen to the 6 minutes, and then we'll go back to this, and you're going to make a determination. We're going to do some work at your tables. You're going to do some individually, and then you're going to have some discussion at your tables about this. But right now, with as long as the technology is really doing what it's supposed to do, we're going to listen to this. Ready?
Thanks, Cheryl, for coming in today. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about your drinking.
Well, I guess I've just had some concerns that the quantity of my drinking's gone up a little bit lately, and I'm wondering what's going on.
Mm-hmm. So you're worried about how much you're drinking?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What are you worried about?
Well, I guess I've heard some comments from my husband, and some of my friends have noticed and said something, and once they said something, I really realized that I should probably take a look at it.
So your friends and family members have convinced you to look at your drinking?
I don't know if convinced me, but
mm-hmm.
they've definitely said something about it, so
mm-hmm.
it's just good to be aware and see where I'm at.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like other people see your drinking as a problem, but you really don't.
Yeah, I guess. And I didn't realize, I didn't even think it was a problem. And the only problem is that they say it's that
mm-hmm.
I'm drinking more than I usually do.
Mm-hmm. What are they saying about your drinking?
Just, hey, don't you think you've had had more than you usually have? What's going on? You seem to be drinking more days than you usually do. What's going on? Why is that happening?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they're really noticing a difference.
Yeah.
And what do you make of that?
Well, I think they're noticing a difference, maybe in amount, but I don't see how any problems have arisen from that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not like I'm drinking more and I'm blacking out or something, or
mm-hmm.
you know, causing trouble in my family or having fights.
Mm-hmm.
Still the same old person. I'm just drinking a bit more.
Mm-hmm. But you don't see any consequences resulting from it?
Well, maybe it's a little bit harder to get up in the morning. I feel a little bit more fuzzy-headed than usual.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. But nothing that would make you want to change anything?
I don't know if want to change anything. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm still... I feel like I really enjoy drinking,
mm-hmm.
and it helps me relax when I come home at night. And maybe it's because I've been a little bit more stressed at work, so I've increased the amount and increased the days that I drink.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing I've seen is people have noticed, taken a notice, and of course I don't want people to think I'm drinking too much, in their opinion, too much. But I am really feeling a little bit fuzzy-headed and a little bit more tired and maybe a little bit more run down. So
there's some things going on there.
Yeah, there's a few things, I guess you'd say. That'd be fair to say.
Well, so it sounds like some people are concerned about it. You have a few concerns, but you're not quite sure what you want to do about that.
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering, you know, if just cutting down is fine. Just cut down a little bit more to back where I was and get rid of that fuzzy feeling in the morning. And that might be sufficient. You know, that might just be fine.
Cutting down.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work for everyone.
What do you mean by that?
Well, some people try and cut back on their drinking, but, you know, they still have problems. They still have, you know, negative consequences. So oftentimes clients come in here and they think that cutting back would be a reasonable alternative for them, but it really doesn't work.
So you're saying that the only way to do this is for me to quit totally?
Well, it's really up to you. I mean, you're the only one who can make that choice. But people that I've seen haven't been successful with that.
Hmm. Well, I kind of disagree with you there. I think that I could probably... I when I was at the level of drinking that I was just before this, I was fine.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have problems.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the difference if I just cut back down to that level? Seems
all
fine
right.
to me.
All right. Well, it's really, you know, it's up to you. You're really going to be the one that makes that decision, and I can't tell you what to do. I just was giving you some insight. But it sounds like, you know, if you want to cut back, how do you think you would go about doing that?
Well, you know, I guess because one of the things was that I wasn't aware that I was drinking much more until people pointed it out. So maybe I could just, well, I don't know, maybe I could just kind of keep track.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe set myself some goals and some limits and
mm-hmm.
see if that works.
That's a really good idea. How would you go about keeping track?
You know, I guess I could count the glasses. I don't know any other mm-hmm. way. You know, I drink
mm-hmm.
wine, so other than getting a clean glass every time and counting them up or something, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have some information about that. Do you mind if I give you some? Would you be interested in that?
Well, yeah, that'd be fine.
So sometimes people can monitor their drinking, you know, in terms of how much they drink and situations that they're in, and they keep track of it every day. And that's been found to really help people keep an eye on what's going on. Is that something that you think you'd be interested in doing?
Yeah, I think so. And the reason why I think so is because I'd much rather take care of it now and cut down than have to quit completely later because I've really let it become a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be a good idea, you
mm-hmm.
know, kind of get a handle on it now.
If you can cut back now, you won't have to quit altogether.
Yeah, and I can still use it in a reasonably sane manner.
Yeah, it's just hard for you to know what a reasonably sane manner it is, it sounds like.
I don't know if it's hard for me to know. I think I'm kind of getting aware of it now.
Mm. Well, good, good. Is there anything else that you think I can help you with today?
Well, you know, like I said, I think I've been more stressed lately, so that's why I've been using more alcohol. And if I cut back, you know, I'm still going to be using some, and that's going to help with the stress some. But what if I'm overwhelmed? I think that's one of the things that might stand in my way.
Mm-hmm. Not knowing how to deal with that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly there's things that we can do in order to help you deal with that feeling. And it's great that you noticed that that's something that causes you to drink more. That's really good. So why don't we talk about that next session? That can be something that we work with.
All right, so for now I should just kind of keep track of what I'm drinking?
Yeah, if you can keep track, and there's some stuff that I can give you, some handouts, and Yeah, that's been found really helpful. So why don't you give that a try, and we'll see if it'll work for you.
Okay.
Good. Thank you for coming in today.
All right, thanks.
Now, many of you may recognize the therapist as Jen Knapp Manuel, somebody who is really good at doing motivational interviewing, but was asked to make a tape in which she portrayed a mediocre therapist. And she agreed to do it, even though she had misgivings, because it took some guts. It does take some guts to do a bad sample of yourself doing MI, because there's inevitably going to be people who will misunderstand that, right? So I think it's time for us to pause just a moment and reflect upon the contributions of those who are willing to be misunderstood in order to serve the greater good of our learning in our organization.
I do have to say that Terry wanted us to use her sample, and anyone can go to the CASA website and download these MP3 files or whatever they're called and the transcripts for coding. And Terry wanted us to use her sample in which she got ones, and she was just too hopeless. It wasn't this therapist that she played was never going to make it to advanced practice, so we decided that it wasn't a good idea to use that one. It was just too bad, but she had a lot of fun doing it. Okay. So I see that many of you have already got the transcripts out. I will tell you that I know there are not enough transcripts, so you're going to have to share. I had 125 copies, and like I said, I missed the outside tables, but you might, look around, and
there might be extra copies
on some of them, and if you have a table with none, you might find one.
So if you need a copy or have a need for a copy at your table, raise your hand, and perhaps someone will be kind enough to bring you one.
So there's not going to be enough for everybody. You're going to be doing this as a table exercise anyway, so it's okay if there's not one for every table. Okay. So the first task for you to do, and I want you to kind of think about this individually before you have some table discussion about it, is to pick the high point of self-exploration. What was the high point of what this client said? Where was the most self-exploration happening? And it could be in one utterance, it could be in a sort of little series. What is the time frame? So think about that. Really just take 20 seconds to identify that and to give it in your mind a rating for what that high point was based on the criteria up here in front of you. And as soon as all of you at your table have done that individually, I'm going to give you a few minutes at the table to discuss and find out if you are in agreement or what your thoughts are. Just have a little discussion about it. Okay. All right. You're going to get to go right back into this, so I'm going to add to the complexity just a little bit here, because I want you to do a couple more things now with the transcript. The other thing, that, of course, that we learn how to recognize from our clients is change talk. And so what I want you to do with this is to go through it and identify the change talk and identify the sustained talk. All right? So you've already determined the high point of self-exploration. I want you to identify the change talk and the sustained talk. And another way of looking at self-exploration is to look at the utterances. So if you are up to it, you can look at the level. This is just a condensed version for utterances about the self-exploration. So you're really looking for the level of self-exploration, because this is where the missed opportunities are, and look at level one, where there's no personally relevant material, and level two, where the the client may give it, the counselor may, you know, may ask a little bit for it, but it's really not very, not much substance to it. And at the level three, it's where the client is really actively initiating, discovering, where you can sense it. And there are a couple of those in this transcript. So go through it for change talk, sustained talk, and the level of self-exploration. And you're going to be having some discussion about the interaction of those, but just see what you find. Go for it. Okay. Happy coders. Isn't coding fun? Yeah. You can keep coding, you know, you can keep coding after we're done here. We'd be thrilled to have you keep coding. But in order for the sake of time, we're going to pull you back. Did you make it through the transcript? No. Okay. that isn't you need Ritalin to code. Okay.
Not very encouraging.
One thing that Terry and I were talking about yesterday, that we're going to talk a little bit more about using transcripts, but one thing that we were thinking about yesterday that we have both had this experience with, one of the best things for advancing practice is to have somebody actually listen to and transcribe their own session. So, believe me, they don't like doing it. But I have had more people come back to me and say, I learned so much about my own process by doing the transcription myself. So even if they're only transcribing 15, 20 minutes, and it may take them 10, 20 hours, it can be very beneficial for them to learn and to listen at that kind of a deep level where they're having to transcribe for themselves. So it's a great learning tool for them to be able to do it. Have you got a transcriber there? Pedals help, yes. Oh, that's great.
I sometimes think that the best way to learn how to do motivational interviewing is to learn how to code it first.
Yes.
And code a lot of tapes, and I've found that makes a huge difference in the ability of people to acquire motivational interviewing once they start to try to learn it after they've been coding.
Yes. So coding... learning to code is a really valuable tool. Also, there's other things that you can do with the transcript. It gives the person an opportunity to slow down, whether they're using transcripts from, you know, like Jenny Hedema's tapes are all transcribed. And you can get the transcripts so you can actually work them. And I've used those in training, any of them that you can use in training where you can actually break down, slow down the process so that people can begin to recognize those transitions. When Terry was talking about how do you code the intent, well, you still can't code the intent with a transcript, but you really can get a lot more into the quality of that interaction and how it changes and how it builds, how the building of change talk happens, or how the missed opportunities, what happens there, and what you might be able to do instead. And did any of you here go to the presentation at ICME of the woman whose name is out of my mind right now, but from Finland who's doing conversation analysis? Did anybody go to that? Yeah. Wasn't that interesting?
Did anybody pronounce her name? Say her name? I can't pronounce it.
It's a really good presentation. But in that analysis, in the conversation analysis, she was looking at the match between what the counselor said and what the client said in terms of both content and sort of process. Like, were they missing or were they, and she had some great examples of where the client would say something and the counselor would say something that would come in at a completely different, completely miss the point, and looking at those connections. Another way of helping people really understand, how do you match your client? How do these things happen where you end up on a completely different place, or how can you really work with the client to build together? So the transcripts can really help you do that. And The other thing that the interaction, I mean, I'm really interested in, when in putting this together, we did a lot of the coding of this and looking at the interaction between change talk and self-exploration, because there's some connections and some differences. So there were examples in this where the self-exploration was high. These were just two of the quotes out of there. But there's also change talk in there. Okay, so there's the both are happening, and you could still see that you could take it a lot farther. You could really build on it, which because she was not being as good as she could, and working to not be as good as she could, she didn't build on it. And there were also some examples where you have high, and actually this was an example where we had differences of opinion about whether or not there was sustained talk, change talk, or nothing in this. But what's really clear is that it's a really good self-exploration statement, right? So it is one of those things where this is part of the difficulty in advanced practices, helping people. I call it the sniff test. If it smells like change talk, it's probably in there somewhere. And I got to find it. And this is exactly the kind of statement that you absolutely would want to know when you're doing therapy, and you would want to build on, and you would want to give the opportunity to try to really build towards change talk. And so it can be helpful in working with folks on that. Okay. The other thing you can also use the transcripts. They're also very good tools for helping with reflection. So as Terry was mentioning, you know, the basic skills of being good at reflective listening, and the MITEI is really helpful in terms of us, our understanding about the quantity of reflections, the ratio of reflections to questions, coding percent complex reflections. Coding complex reflections is really hard to do reliably. It's the hard, only really hard behavior count to get. People will really disagree about whether or not something's complex. However, the transcript can really help you work with somebody on deepening their reflections and also identifying, because looking at it and say, what is the added meaning? What does make this complex? What would have been a more complex response to that self-exploration or that change talk or whatever it is, you can break that part, that piece apart too. And looking at accuracy of the reflections. So transcripts can really help in that regard, as well, about when did you hit the mark and when were you off and what was it about that. It can help people really understand. And my belief is, you know, changing clinician behavior is really hard. And probably harder than changing client behavior. And in reality, we it comes down to people becoming responsible for and their own practice and what they do in that session, because nobody's in there telling them, you know, you can listen afterwards, but people need to become responsible for, and we need to give them the tools to really be able to recognize their own process and become responsible for their changing their own behavior within that session, or paying attention to their behavior within that session. Paying attention to the client, listening to the client, learning from the client in the moment. Just my thoughts. I'm always happy to share my thoughts, as many of you know. Finally, we really believe that paying attention to the client behavior, and not just the client behavior within the session, but the client experience, as Terry mentioned earlier, of really looking at what the client's experience, because they'll tell you something that was completely unrelated to what you thought was happening, and what you thought was important, paying attention to what the client is doing is really helpful. And looking at their speech, you can really help facilitate the recognition of opportunities, both the missed ones and the ones. It's really very reinforcing to see a series of interactions where you can actively see yourself building change talk and responding to the personal material that the client is giving you and really drawing on it. That's a very reinforcing thing just to see it. And again, we think that it's helpful to teach people to code. And the transcripts are really good at providing both these and these, by the way, are all on the CASA website. So there's 5 training tapes, and they're the blank transcripts like you have, and they're also Mighty coded transcripts. So there's some of the client behavior, and you can download those, as well as the MP3 files you can download. And I don't,
for free.
And I don't know if this is the end of it. I don't know if we've got all the client stuff that's important, but we certainly think that change talk and self-exploration are a big step. Okay. So. So here. I don't think Terry will ever get me to run dogs around rings and jump through hoops and run over bridges like she does. She'll never get me to do that. She might talk me into knitting once in a while because she does do that too, but I figure we'll still be talking about coding. Thank you.